south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
Man, the things you discover when you're not even looking to discover anything. Now, you longtime listeners may remember me talking about when I was a kid, I used to read everything. I'd sit on the john, even. Pull out the Lysol and Drano bottles from under the sink and read the labels, which inadvertently made me the child expert on under-counter toxic bathroom chemicals. My friends thought I was nuts, and the adults thought I was sick. So anyway, since I've always been kind of addicted to reading anything that's just sitting around, from appliance repair manuals to digging up fossils to building the Eiffel Tower, that means I'm a repository of lots and lots of useless data. But along the way, it's inevitable you pick up some really interesting tidbits, too. Sometimes stuff that relates or indirectly relates to the theme of this show, living in Latin America. For example, we all know that one of the major hurdles, stumbling blocks to getting along in Latin America is learning Spanish, right? In fact, I'd say only about 1 out of 50 tourists, that is gringo tourists, in Latin America, know any more than what can get them by a Taco Bell. And it seems the vast majority of gringos and expats that end up living in Mexico land on the tourist trail, so they never really have to learn their Spanish. And most seem to be good with that. Why? Because they figure there's enough gringos around speaking English and locals that can speak English, they never have to give it any real effort. Even though it is a fact, and I've said this many times, the more Spanish you know, the lower your cost of living. Ironically, when you talk to people up in the States who have, for example, Latinos moving in their neighborhood who don't speak English, they get all pissed off and say, they're in our country, damn it, why don't they learn our language? Personally, I'm in that camp too. But don't, on the other hand, think you can move to Latin America and get away with not learning their language. At least you should make a good stab at it. Worse yet, you read in rags like International Living and other gringo magazines telling you to move to Panama and Costa Rica and Mexico and such, saying, you don't have to learn Spanish, come on down. There's enough English spoken, you could fit right in. Oh yeah? How would you like if a Spanish language newspaper or rag said the same thing to people moving to the United States? You don't have to learn their language, you don't need English. There's enough Spanish spoken in the U.S. that you could fit right in. Though, unfortunately, that happens to be true. The word's out amongst the poor and lower classes. They don't have to speak English to move to the States. And no matter how much of a do-gooder you think you might be, remember this. Poor folks have poor habits. Funny how so many do-gooders want the borders opened, yet they certainly don't want them living in their neighborhood. Hypocrites, just like the Pope, who says, it's a sin for Europe not to welcome Arab and African refugees. Yet the Vatican, one of the wealthiest countries in the world, has not accepted a single refugee. Moral of that story? Never trust pallid old white guys in funny hats. But I digress. Man, did I digress. Where were we? Oh yeah, you've also heard me say the farther you live off the gringo tourist trail, the quicker you pick up your Spanish. You're forced to. It's a trial by fire. And there's more and more evidence now that learning Spanish or any kind of second language is very good for your brain. That's why when we started the show today, I brought up my crazy reading habits. Because, you see, I just happened to have read a book by a brain surgeon. About what else? Brain surgery. Hey, who knows? It might come in handy someday. Anyway, in that book about brain surgery, I stumbled on a little anecdote regarding people who go under the knife who are fully bilingual, English and Spanish. In this case, the surgeon that wrote the book had to do a delicate brain operation on a bilingual lady with a brain tumor. So now, I'd like to read a few crazy excerpts from this book. Though possibly cringeworthy, they're never boring. But first, let's talk about some of the not-so-obvious benefits of being bilingual. So then, how exactly does bilingualism pay off in brain performance? Well, dozens of studies have demonstrated the benefits on attention and focus. And here's what you didn't know. The benefits are due in part to the fact that a bilingual person's brain must actively suppress one language when he or she's speaking the other. So being bilingual actually works your brain harder. So being able to handle that extra workload results in a stronger overall control of your attention span. Studies have shown over and over again that bilingual people have increased attention spans over monolingual people. On top of that, brain scans have shown the better a person speaks a second language, the thicker the gray matter on the left parietal lobe cortex. So the brain actually grows when you're bilingual. In fact, neurologists can even tell by a brain scan if a person's learned more than one language. Better yet, in repeatable brain studies, the first one published in 2007 by researchers in Toronto, showed that people who spoke more than one language developed symptoms of dementia or Alzheimer's 4 years later than people who were only monolingual. Since that study in 2007, many other studies, one in Montreal, India, Belgium, etc., confirm protective side effects against dementia in bilingual people. You knew that already, right? But here's what you didn't know. At least I didn't till I read the book. I mean, really, who would unless you're a brain surgeon or your hobby is reading books about brain surgery? The surgeon who wrote this book talks about a surgery, a typical surgery for removing a brain tumor. In this case, from a Latina patient named Maria, who's fully bilingual. She's a 36-year-old teacher. If this story doesn't fascinate you, then you just might be one of Elon's AI simulations. All right, let me read you a little bit of what was going on in the surgeon's mind. He says, if I was going to remove Maria's tumor without destroying her ability to speak and understand language, I needed to map the entire surface of her unique cortical canopy, exploring the safe versus language-sensitive spots in her brain. You see, I needed to cut through that section of her brain to get to the tumor. And I had to do all this while she was awake and able to guide me through the process. He says, I needed her to be awake to help me determine tiny islands of brain tissue that could be parted and serve as portals as I cut deep inside her brain to reach the tumor. He said, I told Maria and her husband I would have to remove the top of her skull, that part, under anesthetic, but then he'd have to wake her. She would need to tell me by her ability to speak or not where it was safe for me to begin dissecting. And because she was bilingual, I would have to check each spot twice, once for English and again for Spanish. He said, in the beginning of the surgery, when her scalp, skull, and dura were opened, it would have been too painful for her to be awake for that portion because of the bone saw. But because the brain itself has no nerves to feel pain, the anesthesiologist was now able to dial back the sedative in preparation for the real work once the top of her skull was removed. So when she was awake again, I said, welcome back, Maria. Are you okay? She said, yeah, just a little groggy. Is my brain open? Note that days earlier, we had practiced an operation simulation so she knew her role in the process. So we started. The doctor said, in my left hand, I held an electric stimulator, a device the shape and size of a fountain pen. The twin tips are forked like a snake's tongue, the tiny air gap in between. When I press a button, it releases a tiny electrical current that runs from one of the contacts to the other, allowing me to temporarily stun a tiny piece of tissue between those two points. The brain, however, cannot feel my touch. It doesn't have the ability to know when it's being touched, cut, or manipulated. But the zapped neurons are momentarily stunned, resulting in the loss of whatever function they possess. So we started. The neurophysiologist asked her to count to 10. She did. He asked her to sing the alphabet in English. She did. Now he repeated both questions in Spanish, her native tongue. She performed flawlessly. I was ready to test, probe, and cut. Then he says, I lowered the electric stimulator onto a spot on the edge of her speech area. The neurophysiologist posed Maria a list of questions in both English and Spanish, each of which she also answered flawlessly. He held up objects and asked her to identify them, and all went well. Then he says, I started to stimulate an adjacent area. The neurophysiologist asked Maria to sing the whole alphabet as I zapped the spot with the stimulator. She kept right on singing. Then she went through the song again in Spanish. I waited till she was halfway through to zap it. She stopped at the letter N as if I'd pressed a mute button on her. Her speech was arrested. I knew this spot was a no-go, so I placed a tiny red piece of confetti on the area with a letter S for Spanish. We repeated the process for an hour and got a topographic map of the language critical areas of her left brain. It was covered in a mosaic of white and red confetti. Some of the red no-go bits had an E for English and some had an S for Spanish, and some had an ES for both. Where I had placed the white pieces of confetti, that meant I could dive through the brain's surface underneath to get to the tumor and not affect any of her speech areas. I began to cut. I reached the edge of the tumor. Now, a week earlier, Marina and her husband and I discussed two possible scenarios if things went wrong. If, for example, I found it necessary to cut into her speech areas and necessarily destroy some of her speech centers. She said, Doc, if I have to choose the language to lose, I'll lose the English. She said, take the English if you have to, but leave me the Spanish. So that's what the doc had to do. To completely remove that cancer, he dissected through the brain tissue that mysteriously housed her English-speaking abilities. And now it's been 5 years since that surgery. She's cancer-free, but she only speaks Spanish. She lost her English abilities completely. It was her choice. It could have been the other way around. Wow, how about that? Real interesting stuff. Well, it is to me. Makes you wonder what would happen if you had a brain injury and you only knew one language. Oh, I get it. So that's what happened to Maxine Waters and Babbling Biden. But I digress, as usual. By the way, this book on brain surgery is a really good read. If you want to read about the brain and some other interesting stories like that, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com, and I'll send you a copy. Which begs the question, how's your Spanish coming? As for me, I'm a language don, so I've been down here a long, long time, and I'm still probably no more than an 8, and I'll never be any more than an 8. By the way, the three biggest obstacles preventing gringos and expats from learning Spanish, or at least enough to get by. Number one is living around and hanging with gringos and expats most exclusively. Number two, basic laziness, part of which includes leaning on someone you know or a friend who speaks Spanish pretty well, so you lean on them all the time for the translations. Number three, Google Translate, a crutch that's also highly correlated to laziness. Full disclosure here, you'll probably call me a hypocrite, but once in a while I do use Google Translate. For example, when I'm dealing with legal documents in Spanish, they're long and drawn out, sometimes 5, 6, 10 pages long, and I'll run them through Google Translate because it's just so damn tedious to go through a contract in Spanish. Going through legalese in English is torture enough, but in Spanish, forget about it. Other than that, I don't use Translate apps at all. Fact is, I hate Google and what it stands for so much that when I sometimes need to translate a contract or some kind of legal document, I feel like a traitor to the cause when I'm doing it. The other thing that hampers my Spanish abilities a bit is that I'm slightly deaf in certain tonal ranges from playing so many years on stage behind loud amps. Because of that, I have another problem. Sometimes I'll ask a person who's speaking me in Spanish to repeat themselves. And that's okay if you're dealing with people on the street or mechanics or people you don't know that well. But if all your friends and acquaintances happen to be Spanish speakers who don't know English or not enough to get by, I notice that sometimes they'll get a little annoyed when I ask them to repeat themselves. They, not realizing that Spanish is my second language and I'm not as fluent as they are. They don't realize it because I'm immersed in their world, which is all Spanish conversations 24/7. They forget it's my second language and don't cut me the slack that cut you and other expats and gringos who obviously can't just dive in and shoot the shit with them in Spanish right off the cuff. By the way, I know lots of you listeners out there have the same problem. Too much loud rock and roll music and you're getting a little deaf too, aren't you? You'll know for sure when you've been watching TV a long, long time and someone walks in and says, "What's wrong with you? It's way too loud. You deaf or something?" The fact is that I've been living off the gringo tourist trail for so long. I sometimes forget certain words in English. And sometimes my friends who don't speak Spanish and the ones up in the States, when I'm communicating with them, will accuse me of mixing the two languages. In other words, I'll say a passage, phrase, or paragraph in an English conversation, and I'll drop in a few words of Spanish unknowingly. I won't even realize it till they point it out. Maybe that's normal for gringos and expats who've been down a very long time. When the exact English word doesn't come to mind, your brain fills it in with Spanish, and you don't even know it. Could be your two language centers, Spanish and English, automatically pick the path of least resistance when a certain word's not at the tip of your tongue. Who knows? But it does happen. It's happened to me. Or maybe it's me who's next in line for brain surgery. Bottom line, science has proved bilingualism absolutely pays off in brain performance. All right, switching gears. Let's talk about beating up your kids here in Latin America. Personally, I've only seen it happen a couple of times. Twice in a big grocery store, you know, when kids are running wild and the parents rein them in big time. Saw it one time at a wedding, at a water park, at a street event, a parade where kids were running wild and their parents reined them in. And then there's the case of the lady that I'd often buy coconut water from. She had a machete, she cut it open and handed it to me. Once, one of her little kids ran up to me to say hi and he dropped a cup of juice he was carrying and soaked my shoes. No harm done to me, but his mom was embarrassed, so she came over and clocked him one. A little excessive, I thought, but back when I was a kid, we all took the occasional licking and we lived with it. And somehow, we never turned into whiny, emotional basket cases, did we? Anyway, regarding Latinos disciplining their kids, I've seen it a half dozen times in my 30-plus years down here now. As a rule, kids down here are so much more well-behaved than kids up in the States. Though it seems that's the rule only with the lower and middle classes. The upper middle classes and wealthy classes, they treat their kids the same as the American middle and upper classes treat their kids, like little princes and princesses that can do no wrong in the eyes of their mommies and daddies. So as far as my experience, I've only seen rude and misbehaving kids in the so-called upper middle class and wealthy gringo wannabe classes. You regular listeners might remember that story I told about 6 months ago now, when my gringo friends and I were confronted with a screaming kid in an upscale restaurant at 11 o'clock at night. And the parents and the people around didn't do a thing. Only me, the rude gringo, spoke up, only to be bitched at by an upscale gringo wannabe who obviously went to a helicopter school herself because her English was pretty good. She was definitely infected with gringo parenting tendencies. In fact, down here in Latin America, there seems to be a very high correlation between wealth and badly behaved kids. It's funny, it seems the more a family is struggling and hurting for door, the more poor they are, basically, the better behaved their kids. Sort of counterintuitive, maybe because the parents don't have the time, inclination, or temperament to put up with an unruly kid. And that, combined with the fact that many adolescent kids, 10, 11, 12 years and above, in lower and middle class families, which makes up about 90% of families in Latin America, those kids actually have a job, work at something to contribute financially to the family. They have to. That puts a responsibility on poor and middle class kids at a very early age. Now, I know there's lots of talk about that child labor problem. The thing is, though, most of these kids remain in school and work on the side. It's not like they lie about their age and their parents shove them in a sweatshop. These days, so-called sweatshop owners could get in big trouble for that, so they demand a government ID. Those sweatshops are unionized, so they're pretty strict about that. But underage kids do work. You see it all the time. School-age kids, 10, 12, 14 years old, selling crap on the street. Shining shoes, washing cars, selling eggs and candy, sharpening knives, grinding out keys, handing out flyers, washing windshields. Hey, nothing wrong with that as long as they're still going to school. And to their credit, most of them are doing both. Most often, they need to be working, too, for the family to make ends meet. Now, you may have heard of this Latin American thing called the canasta básica. That's the basic so-called basket of combined items a family of four needs to survive for a month. Obviously, since every country is a little bit different, the calculation is a bit different for each country, too. For example, in June of 2022, the cost of living for a family of four, your so-called basic family basket, canasta básica, made up of 75 products and services, by the way, was estimated to be $529. So, as of June 2022, the average Latino family of four in Ecuador spends $529 a month. That includes food, rent, utilities, clothes, transportation, etc. But since the average legal basic salary in Ecuador is only $425 a month, one worker in the family just won't cut it. You have to have 1.6 people earning the basic salary to cover it for a family of four. So then generally, you have the mother and the kids over 10 or 12 years old chipping in. Having that mission at a young age to help the family seems to make the kids hardworking, diligent, non-whiners who listen to their parents and don't act up in public. Just like up in the States, though, the more kids have, the more the parents do for them, the more entitled they think they are. Same old story, but you knew that already. By the way, I've got a Latino friend, Jorge. He's got three super well-behaved kids. He and his family are slightly above middle-class Latin American style. His wife runs a Mary Kay business, you know, women's products door-to-door. And he, well, he's got a loan shark business. That's legal down here, kinda. And he's in the beauty parlor product supply business. So they're slightly above middle-class Latin American style. I bet they make around $1,500 a month between them. It's a family of five. Thing is, the kids work a bit in the business, too. And, you know, every time I've been around him and his kids, I notice his kids are very happy and they're always amusing themselves and playing nice and quiet, never interrupting adults or screwing with them or demanding things. There's three boys, 8, 10, and 16. I remember once not so long ago I said, Jorge, your kids are pretty well behaved. I bet you don't have to discipline them much. He said, we're pretty much over that phase, but if they get out of line, I'll bring out the chancla. The chancla or chancleta is a shoe or a sandal. He said that's an age-old tradition down here. You punish your kids early on by whacking them a few times in the butt with a chancla or
chancleta.
He said after a while, you don't have to whack them anymore. You just point to your shoe and they get the idea real quick. Though he said it's usually the mother or grandmother in the family, you know, they usually live in the same house, that will whack the kid with a chancleta, since dad's usually gone out working. And like Jorge says, you got to strike while the fire is hot. You got to punish him in the act. You can't wait and promise the kid he'll get whacked when daddy comes home. So, bottom line, whacking your kids when necessary is alive and well here in Latin America. And guess what? Surprise, surprise. It seems to have produced a more respectful and courteous breed of kid. Now, of course, most Latinos, they know how lenient parents are up in the States. They know parents won't whack their kids because they believe it's cruel, it's inhumane, it's child abuse. Besides that, some of them have heard stories that the kids have all the control. They can dial a number, social services will come over, and the parents will be in big trouble. Yeah, well, that doesn't fly down here in Latin America. Not yet, anyway. Remember, there's big lag time in almost all areas. Though I suppose in 15 or 20 years, the way things are going, a system like that just might kick in down here in Latin America, but it's doubtful. Then again, 20 years ago, who in America ever would have thought the wokesters, the LGBTWTFs, BLM, and the cancel culture terrorists, along with Big Brother, Big Media, and Big Pharma, would have the final word concerning your life? By the way, how's your Plan B coming? Anyway, Jorge admits he had to discipline his kids in the early days by whacking them with a shoe. The chancla, or chancleta treatment. What an evil and despicable man. And now a quick email from Ellie. She says, Johnny, with all the dire warnings of how global warming is going to melt the planet within the next few years, we've got the coming financial catastrophe and possible nuclear war on the horizon, triggered by the Ukrainian thing. On the bright side, if a few nukes are dropped, there'll be less population, so Bill Gates will be happy. There'll be less need for pipelines and carbon-based fuels. The resulting dust clouds will plunge the world into a little ice age, which should make those obese porkers, Michael Moore and Al Gore, and the tree huggers in the green movement, exceedingly happy. And since supply chains will be totally disrupted, survivors will have to get used to growing their own and buying local instead of from the Chinese. What's not to like about that? People just don't realize, Johnny, that every nuclear cloud has a radioactive silver lining. Signed, Ever the Optimist, Ellie, from North Carolina. P.S. What are the dates for your next seminar? I need to petition my boss to get that time off. When you work for the man, you just can't bug out on a moment's notice. All right, thanks for that, Ellie, and thanks for that positive pep talk. Even terrible tragedies aren't all bad. And it's been proven, you know, that positive thinkers live longer. Though in the case of nuclear war, it might only be a few seconds longer, still it is longer. Then again, if you happen to be sitting in Latin America somewhere, a couple of thousand miles from the action, that is, thousands of miles from any strategic target, there's a good chance you could sit back and watch the first world implode from a nice safe distance. Though I wouldn't want to be living anywhere near a U.S. border or the Panama Canal or anywhere in Panama. Yep, for all you Panama lovers out there, you know, the Panama Canal is the only nuclear strategic strike zone in all of Latin America. You knew that, right? You know, there are many nuclear winter studies out there. One recently from Louisiana State and Rutgers University says that if just two countries, for example, started dropping nukes on each other and no one else got involved, that's always a possibility. Like, for example, Pakistan and India, you know, they don't like each other. Or Russia and Ukraine. They say in the first month following the detonation, the average global temperature would drop by 10 to 13 degrees Fahrenheit and remain that way for quite a few years. Not an experiment we'd like to try, but with all that lunatic saber rattling out there, it's never completely out of the question. Though I doubt it's on people's reasons to get out of Dodge top 10 list. Nevertheless, it's always a lurking possibility. Just imagine a nutcase like Hitler sitting in a bunker moments before his death. If he'd have had nukes and had a button to launch them, you don't think he would have pushed it? Yep, in politics, psychopaths always rise to the top. On a lighter note, the other day I was on a big highway going through a toll booth. You can't get away from them. Every country in Latin America has tolls here and there. And sometimes when you're going through places like Mexico where lots of gringos are coming in and out, gringos are targets and easy to gouge at high-priced toll booths. You'll see at those tourist areas where there are lots of gringos, the tolls are heavy. Anyway, the other day it was raining. This is the rainy season. And I was going through a toll, and right on the side of the road, they had a gas station and a convenience store, you know, Auto Mart, where you could sit and have a cup of coffee. I sat down and situated myself looking straight at the toll booth, watching the cars come through and pay, etc. From there, I could make out the prices of the tolls for cars, trucks, minibuses, etc. At that particular place, it was about $1 for cars, $2 for minibuses, and depending on how many axles, prorated for trucks. Now here's the thing. The sign said 35 cents for motorcyclists. 35 cents in the local funny money, that is. And as I sat there having a brownie and a cup of coffee, I saw at least 30 motorcyclists go through without paying. They just whipped around the side of the toll gate, avoiding it, and going on the shoulder of the road, right past the ever-present big line of cars. Not to mention 5 or 6 cops and some military police standing at every toll booth, kind of just lounging around like a bunch of slugs doing nothing. Didn't bother them that the motorcyclists were just whipping on through and not paying. They didn't bat an eye. So the motorcyclists would come up, buzz right through, jump the toll, and without fear, when there was a cop or a military guy standing not 3 feet away. Now, in this little gas station supermarket, there was a military guy sitting at the table right next to me having his coffee, too. And I asked him, I said, what's it with those motorcyclists? They're buzzing right through without paying. The sign says they're supposed to pay 35 cents. Do they have a free pass or something? He said, oh, yeah, the sign. Well, that 35 cent thing's been on there for years. They never pay. They just buzz right through. That's normal. I guess someone should fix that sign. Then I asked a stupid question. I said, why then, if it's the law, doesn't anyone enforce it? Duh. He said, no one's going to fire up a cruiser and chase a guy down the road for 35 cents. But the way he said it revealed the real reason. The real reason was that if a cop pulled a guy over, it was futile. You see, when you pull someone over, anyone, you either give them a ticket or try to squeeze some mordida out of them, a bribe. And those motorcyclists with those rusted out 90cc rice burners, besides their piece of junk motorcycles, they haven't got a pot to pee in. Oftentimes, they don't even have 50 cents to put fuel in the tank, much less pay a $25 fine for toll jumping. As for having bribe money, well, the cops know that's completely out of the question. If they have a hard time keeping gas in the tank, how are they going to have money for a bribe? So there's another little fact of life you learn if you live down here long enough. It also tells a whole lot about how lax the government and bureaucracies are down here. What's not to like about that? By the way, how's your bureaucracy treating you up there in Big Brother land? Cracking down pretty hard, I hear. Oh, one last thing. Ellie was asking about the dates for my next Sexpat Insider Seminar. Wait, did I say Sexpat? Little Freudian slip there. Anyway, we're shooting for October. Planning on a week of the fire hose treatment in the DR, the Dominican Republic this time, by popular demand, to change things up a bit. We haven't picked the exact dates or itinerary yet, so stay tuned. However, to get on the early bird discount waiting list, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com.
You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.